This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Peter D. Hart, who is one of the leading analysts of public opinion in the United States. Since 1971, he has been chairman of Peter D. Hart Research Associates. Peter, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you very much, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in San Francisco and raised in Berkeley, California.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Huge effect, because I grew up in academia. My father was a professor of English at the University of California and Berkeley, and he also was vice chancellor, and in the last 20 years of his career, he was head of the Bancroft Library. So all of academia was, all of my parents' friends were sort of the leading people, not only in the English department, but in other departments, and they were family friends. And I can remember living through the loyalty oath, which was a huge question here at Berkeley.
That would be in the 1950s, right?
That's correct. And I can remember living through the McCarthy Army hearings and being in the living room, and every night being with my parents and listening to that and the other faculty members, and being so central. So, and, you know, everybody came through our house, whether it was Robert Frost, the great poet, or Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, they were all in the house. So it affected me and got me very much involved in public life and public affairs.
Was it hard being young in this atmosphere with the level of the discourse so high, or did you adjust quickly and early?
Well, I don't know that you adjust. That's just what life is, that you don't realize it at the time. It all seems dramatic. It all seems important. You're being the son of an English professor and having other professors around, it always had a narrative to it. It always seemed so important and so central. But to me, my relationship with Berkeley and the University of California was much more through its athletic teams. I mean, I cared desperately about the football team and the basketball team, and I was always down on campus doing something.
And those were years when we won conferences, right?
We had a few good years, but I grew up in a lean period with Pappy Waldorf. But I can tell you that I went to the last Rose Bowl game that the University of California, Berkeley has been at, and that was in 1959. My dad was vice chancellor, and he got me and three of my friends tickets. So we went down to Pasadena, and I will just tell you, I'm ready to go back if the university can comply by winning.
Did you ever think about going to Berkeley once college time came?
I certainly thought very hard about how far away from Berkeley I could get. I ended up at graduating from Colby College in Waterville, Maine. And as the crow flies, I don't think it can fly much further away from Berkeley. I think as much as anything, my sister went to Wellesley. We were looking for our own identity, and these were great academic institutions. I love Berkeley, but I needed a smaller institution.
Before we talk about college, what was your experience of the turbulence of the 60s? Were you coming and going then because you were already in college?
I was already in college, and so I was distant from the turbulence. That was more through discussions with my parents or essentially reading about it. My dad had returned to the English department. He was no longer vice chancellor, so he didn't have to go through all of the problems that the Mario Savio days and all of the protests there.
Mm-hmm. So at Colby, what did you major in?
I majored in history, and English history in particular. But I had a great love of politics and a great interest. And Colby had an interesting program, which was called the January Program. And it allowed us to study independently anything that we wanted. And one year, I decided to study the 7th Congressional District of California, which was the home congressional district here. And it was there that I guess I got my interest both in statistics and in polling. And I just from there found that that was going to be my interest, and that was the area I was pursuing.
So, but did math or statistics ever become part of your curriculum? Or
I'm sad to admit that I never took a single course in statistics or in mathematics. It was just something that I had a natural aptitude for.
And so, was it that research work that's led you? I mean, because you could have said, well, I'll go into politics, I'll run for office, but you really wanted to get the pulse of America, ultimately.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about the influence. I came from a political family, interestingly enough. My mom's mother was a socialist, and she worked for Norman Thomas and started with Eugene Debs, and she was always that way. My grandfather was a Republican. My mom was a liberal Democrat. I worked very hard for Adlai Stevenson and for all of the major causes in Berkeley, housing and busing and all of the things that allowed Berkeley to get integrated. And so I guess I was just very interested in that and public life. And I got an introduction to Lou Harris, who was John F. Kennedy's pollster. And out of college, I was able to get a job there. And that's how I started.
And it was it there that you really learned the trade, that you really mastered what was then the different aspects of polling?
I learned absolutely from the bottom. I'm proud to tell you that I was earning $2 an hour working for Lou Harris in New York. And I literally learned every element of polling. Absolutely, from the bottom, started with the coding department and worked in sampling department. I worked on the election night coverage for CBS. So all of
which
those
election?
Things. It was 1964. It was the first election. I'd graduated from college in 1964, and Lou put me on the election unit, and I got to work at CBS for 3 months just on election night coverage, and that was fascinating.
Did Harris himself mentor you, or did you have any particular mentors in addition to being given a position and testing out all the different units?
Without a doubt, Lou Harris is still a mentor to me. I talk to him every 3 or 4 months just to find out how he's doing and what he's seen. But he was very, very good to me in terms of both teaching me the business, but teaching me lessons of life. And I learned a tremendous amount. I was there on and off for 7 years. I went out and worked on a political campaign. I worked at the Democratic National Committee, and I worked at another firm. But it's Lou who really gave me the lessons of life. And there were a lot of other mentors along the way who taught me an awful lot about polling.
One question I have is, did you ever considered being in the academy, actually? Or was it you really had enough and were ready to go out into the field and experience politics firsthand?
When you say the academy, you mean academics?
Yeah, yeah.
I neither had the credentials nor the abilities to be in academia. I wasn't built that way. My interest was much more in the real world. And my sort of interest and background in academics grew out of doing my work. I can talk about this, but I became a Woodrow Wilson visiting fellow very early in my career. I was about 33 years old, and I was going back to different colleges and teaching for a week. But I had never thought about being an academic, and I never had the grades that would have allowed me to be an academic.
I like to ask my guests what they see as the skills and temperament involved in what they do. Well, the skill set must have really changed over time in your case.
Yeah, the skill set has changed, but it stayed the same. And that is, look, people often say, what does it take to be a really good pollster? And I say, among other things, it takes great judgment, it takes meticulousness, and it takes creativity. Those are sort of the three elements, and I think they get applied differently over time. But I'll tell you the thing that I love about this, and that is that it is really the ability of how do you frame a question in order to be able to get really interesting information. I mean, you have a certain skill of being able to ask really good questions to be able to get underneath and learn a lot about a person. Same thing. I have to go to a broad group of people, whether it is a focus group, which is qualitative, or quantitative, which is a poll. And you have to be able to figure out those words and the set of answers that allows people to be able to express where they're coming from and what they're feeling. And so questionnaire technique is terribly important. Meticulousness comes in if you're talking to 800 or 1,000 people and they represent the whole United States, you better be picking these people in a random, selective way that is representative, and you better be following a whole series of those things. And then finally, the judgment set is 50% a lot or a little? And the ability to be able to understand how to look at numbers and how to put it into context. Those are the things that are there. I think it was true when I entered the business. I think it's true today. The techniques are now so much more it's quicker. It is trickier because back then when I started, everything was done door to door. So we would knock on your door, and if you were kind enough to allow us to do an interview, we had a one-on-one relationship with you. Then we moved to the telephone, and now a lot of our work is done online. We don't even know anything except your sort of the way to reach you, your URL or whatever it may be.
Before we go on with that topic, because I have a line of question I want to ask, what about temperament? In other words, do you have to have a certain kind of character? Persistence must be very important. Patience, not rushing to judgment?
Well, I think all of those things, but I think that really comes back around, as you say, to a sense of judgments about things. But again, I find public opinion just fascinating, and I find it alive. I find it dynamic. I love to get into interviews and into a one-on-one relationship with people because the one thing that you learn from this is a belief in people. People often come up to me and say, geez, the respondents seem so dumb. And to me, in so many ways, they seem so wise and smart. And you look at the elections we've been involved in over a 50-year period, and I think by and large, the American public gets exactly what they want in almost each and every election. And I think when they approach issues, they may not know exactly where Afghanistan is, but they have attitudes of how much involvement and why we should be involved, or the reverse, why was important to get out of Iraq and what we needed to do. Each of those things fascinates me.
So in a way, there is, on the one hand, the quantitative side of your business, but what I hear you bringing to the table is a kind of human insight an intuition about people and a respect for them. And it's by figuring out ways to combine these two perspectives that we're going to get insight from public opinion.
Well, that's what's so fascinating, that if you look at a poll, essentially, it may be 1,000 or 1,500 people expressing attitudes. And you can look at it as numbers, or you can begin to get behind what those numbers are trying to say, because people are trying to tell you something. And the reason I love focus groups, which are qualitative research, is I can hear the voices. The voices are fed back to you. You can see the interaction. You can see the dynamic. You can see people take apart an issue and begin to give you a sense of where they're coming from. I mean, we're in the middle of a very thorny budget situation. And I really honestly believe that if our elected officials were more in touch with the public, they would have a much greater sense that they could compromise and they could come to a middle ground, because the public in many cases is much more reasonable than the Congress is.
As you dig in to get into where people really are in their thinking and feelings, I noticed in one of your focus groups or maybe it was in a lecture, you talk about coming up with human situations that people have insight. Would you want candidate X as a neighbor? Relate the candidates to the characters that you had in high school. Those are entree points for really understanding their understanding, so that you can then get a sense of what their opinion is.
Well, the thing I often tell politicians is the simple idea that either you're going to talk to them or you're going to listen to them talk to you. And the ability to create that bridge and the ability to understand. And people know things down here. I'm getting it up to their mouth. That's what I'm trying to do. And most cases, people think, I want to get it from their brain to their mouth. I want to get it from the gut to the mouth. And let me explain. When I say to somebody, okay, let us suppose so-and-so were your next-door neighbor. Tell me what they're like. All of a sudden, they start to give you insights they won't give you in any other way. I'll give you an example. During a very bad period for Bill Clinton, I asked the simple question of people, it's Sunday morning in the Clinton household. Tell me what's going on. Okay? And this was long before any of the Monica Lewinsky problems. And what they said to me is, Hillary is dressed and she's at her desk and she's working on position papers. This is the first lady. And what's Bill doing? Well, he's either with his putter practicing, or he's on the phone, or he's reading a newspaper, et cetera. And I said, anything else that's happening? Nope, that's about it. There was no daughter in it. There was no sense of family. There was no sense of cohesion. There was no sense. And I told the president of this finding. And if you look, you can see how Chelsea became part of so much of what happened in 1995 and 1996, because it changed the relationship. And you look at the Obamas, and when people talk about them as a family, I do another question, which I say, let us suppose that you had to commute, and the only way to get on the HOV lane was either you have to commute with Mitt Romney or Barack Obama. Who would you choose? Well, even Republicans will tell you I would choose Obama. Why? Well, we talk a little basketball. We would, you know, talk music. He's into movies. He's in. Well, how about Romney? It would be dull. We would be talking about finance. We would be Maybe he'd be talking to me about his religion. He had no sense of a human connection. Well, if you ask people in statistical terms, they can't tell you that kind of thing. And so I'm always looking to find the situation that helps to unlock what people are really thinking and where they're coming from.
Where did this skill come from? Was this just something you intuited, that this was an important entree point to making the data meaningful?
Well, interestingly enough, I think it came from my mom. My mother was just a skilled interviewer as a 1950s housewife. And I guess my friends would come over, and she would get more information in 10 minutes than their parents could get in 5 years. And, I think there was just that skill that sort of came in. And I've always just been interested in people as people and finding the way in which to talk to them on a very human basis, that they can talk to you versus talking on a very high plane, which still stellifies the relationship.
When you take this information to a Bill Clinton or Obama, yep, or Hubert Humphrey, how do you educate them, and how does it change them, basically? Because presumably they're in the business they're in because they feel they want to touch the flesh, they want to know people, but they're missing something. That's what you're bringing to the table.
Well, it's certainly an element, but the answer is everybody relates. And they get it, and they get it immediately. One of the questions I love to ask in terms of corporations: let us suppose it was a sports team, any sports team. What sports team is it, and why? And you'll get all kinds of answers. Then when you go to talk to a CEO, and you say, you know something, people see you as the Kansas City Royals. Oh, my God. No, I'm not the Kansas City Royals. I'm the New York Yankees. They get it immediately. Whereas if you say 53% see you as static and such, it doesn't communicate. So I care about two things. One, understanding what my respondents and what the public is thinking. And two, translating it in a way in which the corporation will be able to understand, or the politician, both elements.
So what you're saying is that without this work, the corporate leader or the politician on the one hand, and the public are talking in such a way that they don't hear each other.
There's a lot of not hearing one another. Yeah. And, you know, if I look at the role of a pollster, I think people look at it in a way and they say, well, there's some sort of black magic to it. That's a black art or whatever else it is. Done right and done well, it becomes a tremendous tool for democracy in helping a leader to understand the parameters in which they can operate and what they can do. And the public right now is talking about gun control and the questions there. Well, the public is screaming out for change in terms of this area, and the politicians can't hear it. And maybe they will never hear it. But in so many areas, whether you look at immigration, whether you look at the question of same-sex marriage, so many issues, the public is ahead of the politicians, and it's the public that allows us to move ahead on so many fronts. So it's that element that excites me and at the same time makes what I do seem worthwhile.
What are the obstacles here in making this connection possible? One, it would seem to be the media, basically, in the sense that the logistics of what they do creates information bubbles in a way around particular issues that then come to dominate the discourse.
Well, The media, obviously, is both the message and the messenger. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that people have that filter. And what's particularly daunting and disturbing about this era is that we've gone to what I call cheerleader school. And people no longer hear the news in objective fashion. They hear it through their own lens. So that if you're part of the university crowd, you're probably watching MSNBC and cheering Rachel Maddow as one of the great heroes of your time. And if you're in the business and conservative field, you're saying Fox, and you're saying Bill O'Reilly is one of your great heroes. Well, the problem here is that you and I grew up in a different era, and we used to listen to Walter Cronkite, or we listened to Huntley and Brinkley, and there was a sense that it wasn't homogenized news, but it was thoughtful news. This is aimed at, how do I draw you to watch me for a day? And if I can get the numbers, then I'm doing a good job. And there's no sense of what it's doing. And you look at what's happened just even during the Boston Marathon bombings. There, how each entity looked at that event through their own filter and their own eyes. So the difficulty of trying to figure this all out is so different and so difficult, and it plays into our field a lot. And obviously, I've been doing the NBC Wall Street Journal polling for this, the 25th year. And you look at that, it's a huge part of journalism today.
Another obstacle seems to be the creation of stories and narratives, big stories, big narratives about what the issues are. And what I have in mind here is the famous Lewis Powell memo defining the agenda for conservatives. I think it was written before Reagan came into power, and how institutionally and in the world of ideas, they really transformed the universe of discourse and to the point where today the focus is on debt, government debt, which may not be what people most care about, but it's what the narrative is.
Well, it goes back to the previous question, which is how much the agenda is controlled by the media and what happens, and then how's the media being fed and what happens here. And, of course, it's the interest groups. And what it really comes down to is something that's bigger and more pervasive and a bigger challenge, and that is how do you get the average voice back into Washington? I mean, essentially what has happened is pay to play, and the money in Washington politics is so egregious and outrageous. I mean, when you spend $2.5 billion on the election for the president, and essentially the only thing that you did is Indiana and North Carolina slightly moved and became Republican this time, and all other 48 states voted exactly the same way. The number of changes in the Senate and in the House were de minimis, and we spent all that money. Well, that continues to get multiplied in terms of what's happening inside Washington, and so you get the anger, the frustration, and the sense of the public looking outside, hoping for a change, hoping for something better.
You know, the argument, you hear the argument, oh, the politician is following the polls. But what you're suggesting is that what the polls done well and in the right way can actually tell politicians what's in the people's mind in order for them to formulate policies and programs to actually lead people, basically, and not just be responsive to them.
Let me take two aspects of your question. First aspect is that the polls are leading the politicians, so the money is leading the politicians, unfortunately. But in terms of polling done well, is not a politician who simply says 51% of the people are feeling thus and such. Let me follow my people, because 2 days later, it's going to be 47% are saying such and such. It is the ability to understand in broad terms what the agenda is and what are the elements of it. Polling done well allows us to understand the consensus of opinion. And that doesn't mean the specifics, but it allows a conservative Republican to be able to say, the public at this stage of the game and moving forward seems to be able to say, you have more latitude on the issue of immigration than you did 10 years ago. That's a poll that's done well. That is something. It's not telling a politician how to vote. It is allowing them to understand what I guess we would call the additional dimension of the public's consensus. And if we can get that, then polling serves us well. When polling has done nothing more than to tell us which candidate's ahead or behind, or does the president have a 52% approval rating, it's a pretty shallow measurement from my point of view.
Now, you said there was a second aspect to my question.
Well, the first aspect was you were saying it's the people leading the policy. No, I think it's the money, and that was the first aspect. Second one was the sense of polling and what it is.
I get the sense in listening to you here and elsewhere that on the one hand, you really want to have your ear to the ground, to know what people are thinking, to come up with language and metaphors that pulls them out of them. But at the other hand, on the other hand, I notice on your company's website, and actually as I hear you talk and participate in focus rooms, you also have a sense of the big picture. You talk about strategy and structure, the way everything hangs together. Talk a little about that, because it's really important in doing the first work that we talked about.
Well, what, you know, often people say, you know, what kind of a profession did you have? I think I had the best profession in the world. I am the luckiest, most fortunate person, because I got to listen to people. I got to play what I say above the rim. I mean, it was the ability to, whether it be doing something for Habitat for Humanity or being able to do something for the Smithsonian Institute or being able to work for Coca-Cola or being able to work for AT&T or being able to work for 40 different United States senators, you get to make a difference. And you get to make a difference by the ability to listen, understand, and to have those who are in a position of influence to be able to change policies and change lives. So I've got to tell you that I look at the big picture all the time, because it's not a matter of trying to get through. Next year will be my 50th year since I started at Lou Harris. And what you realize pretty quickly is that numbers change on a weekly basis. It is the ability to be able to step back and to look at the patterns of history. So in part, my training going all the way back to Colby College of looking at English history, I found very useful, because it forced me into a much broader sense of where things are at.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, you've worked with a number of politicians, especially on the Democratic side. What are your reflections about the quality of leadership over time? Has it remained as high as it was maybe in the beginning? Are they still good listeners when you bring the data to them? Do they pick up on what you're on what you're saying and then act on the insight the way Clinton did?
It breaks my heart that I started, I opened my own firm in 1971. I had, in the course of the period of time I was doing political polling, which was up till about 1990, I had people like Hubert Humphrey that I worked for, Walter Mondale that I worked for, Henry Jackson, Lloyd Benson, Edward Kennedy, great governors across this country. And the sense of scope, the sense of majesty, the sense of history that they brought to the political life was amazing. It's not just because I was young. Even though I was young, I was sitting across from Hubert Humphrey giving him advice and direction in terms of his next political campaign. And the depth and the sense of how you look at issues. I mean, often they would lecture me as I would bring a little number. And I always said that the great ability of both Edward Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, I would come in like this and give them something, and they would stretch it to a huge 3D cinematic viewpoint. And the beauty and the depth that they had. And when I say it breaks my heart, I mean, I take nothing away from any individual United States senator or governor or congressman, but boy, they are just ruled in a wholly different way. Mm-hmm. And so the money has such an effect. The media has such an effect. There isn't the latitude, the bigness of being able to do things. And so we get so far behind. I mean, clearly, in order to deal with the budget, we're going to have to do something about revenues, the budget deficit, and we're going to have to do something about entitlements. The public is much more willing to make those adjustments, and these people are really not willing. And there are too few instances where you can say, look at the great social or historical movements and how politicians led them. And looking at today, they're politicians, they're not big people. And I don't want to say that's true of everyone, but there are too many of them. And in many cases, the best of them leave and the others stay.
And you said ruled by. So what you're saying is that the structure of the politics, the world they get trapped in, money, a congressional district that's been gerrymandered, so that you have to worry about your right if you're a Republican, the left if you're a moderate liberal. So it's the structure of incentives that are entirely different that really don't allow for leadership in a way.
Yeah, it makes it very hard to be a leader. And your point is such a great point, and that is the gerrymandering. If you could change one thing to make the Congress a better Congress, essentially what you do is find a way to get rid of that. Because instead of having 300 districts that should be competitive, we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 districts. And if you're a conservative Republican, your only concern in many instances is being beat in a primary. And the same thing, as you say, with a liberal Democrat. Therefore, the moderate voices or the voices of conciliation and compromise are left out of this.
So in a way, the same thing is happening in the congressional districts that's happening in the media, basically, where you're getting fragmentation and appealing to one constituency.
Totally.
Yeah. Let's talk a little about the Obama revolution in campaigns. In the way that they ran that campaign, have they revolutionized the way people get elected, or has the change not been that great? Twitter accounts, you know, using the communications revolution.
Well, the communications revolution is here, and you see it in every element. The only difference here was that the Obama campaign and David Axelrod, who directed it, understood exactly what they needed to do. I talked to David a lot through the 4 years, but in the last 2 years. And I would say, I was always the voice of doom and the voice of fear. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, look, I'm worried. I'm concerned. And I said, you know, this election's going to depend on turnout. And he was always very confident because he knew all the things that they were doing. And so they understood it, modernized it in many respects. But it's essentially going back to the you know, the 5x8 note card, but modernizing it and all the ways in which you can touch people and get in touch with them. And their turnout, particularly with the Latino vote and the young vote, was remarkable. And so people talk about it as a revolution. Well, the revolution has taken place. They just jumped on the boat and used that revolution exceptionally well. And of course, you're going to see it by the Republicans in the next campaign. And, you know, politics is the most imitative art there is. I mean, we constantly copy what somebody else is doing. And if the Republicans do it one time, the Democrats are going to be all over it the next time.
Is there a particular insight that you can share with us about how you and your organization put all of this together? On the one hand, the human understanding of the human processes, but on the other hand, the statistical, the quantitative, and so on. Is there some secret to that brew, or is it just common sense and judgment?
Well, I always like to hear the word like brew because it suggests that there, again, is some witch's magic that is going on. And indeed, there are really two sides to it. One is the scientific side and the other is the art. And the scientific side is you better do it well. And that means we have a sampling department and they are the ones who are in charge of figuring out where we're going to go to do interviewing and how we're going to go about it. We have three phone banks, one in Akron, Ohio, one in Toledo, and one in Mesa, Arizona, run by tremendous professionals whose job is to make sure that the interviews are done well. And that's exceptionally important. And then we have a tabulation department that has to make sure that you get the information in and you tabulate it. But then the, quote, brew that you talk about is the magic that is done by those people who are analysts or project directors. And they're the ones who look at the data and are able to figure out what is the public trying to say, what it's about. And on the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Hart Research works with public opinion strategy. And the brilliance of both sides working on this together is just marvelous to see because we'll see things through a certain Democratic lens. Public opinion strategies may see things through a Republican lens, but we're both aiming at the same thing, which is understanding public opinion. The brilliance, so to speak, is the seeing the insight that is going to allow you to get more votes or to be able to crystallize an issue. That's the magic, if I can say that.
And it's providing the leader or the corporate head with the room for maneuver as he sort of seeks out his goals.
Well, you have to understand, we're not formulaic. So what we're doing is giving that information. And when you look at great leaders in both politics and in corporate America, they see this and it becomes a way of being able to say, this is where I want to lead. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm looking for from my organization. I mean, you know, corporate America gets more than its share of brickbats from the American public. But, you know, the leaders that I work with at Coca-Cola and AT&T, to name two, you know, they're remarkably good, not in terms of just saying, can I sell an additional soda or can I get people to buy and use my service, but in understanding the much greater forces that are going on. And that's what I like to believe I'm helping on.
As you put this together, you're facing a lot of challenges as technology is changing the environment. All these kids running around with cell phones, these advocacy polls where people are not really concerned about the quality of the work, but in mobilizing their constituency.
Let me break that into two parts. First part is technology. How much we've changed, as I talked to you about going door to door. Then suddenly we've moved to telephone. Now, for our NBC Wall Street Journal polls, 30% of all of our interviews are done with people who have cell phones only. That's only going to climb. You and I are archaic. I get people to stand up in an audience and I say, sit down if you answer yes to one of the following four questions. And I start, the first one is, do you wear a wristwatch? And, you know, bing, most of the old people all sit down, okay, as they check their wristwatch out. The next thing I do is I say, do you have a landline phone at home? Bing, down goes everybody else. Do you read a printed newspaper? Bing, there's nobody left. And then I say, do you use your cell phone more to call than to text? Now, if I ask my students at Berkeley, over half the class are still standing. And so that whole technology revolution is terribly important to take care of. And the ability to be able to change, and it's much harder to interview people today than it used to be. And so that becomes a whole challenge.
Who is it you're talking to basically becomes less clear, or is it skewed to one group?
Well, the answer is we still believe, based on elections, that we get an accurate cross-section. I mean, the last election, we had the president ahead by about 1% in our final polls. I think he ended up about 3% ahead. Obviously, when you're talking to 1,000 or 1,500 people, that's a pretty good reflection. And so we know we still are able to get this. It's just becoming much, much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. And what about the advocacy polls?
Well, that's one of the hard things, because polling is a profession in which, unlike any other profession, you don't need a license. Tomorrow morning, Harry, you can open your own polling firm, and I have no doubt you'd be great. So the tendency is to treat all numbers as equal. And obviously, it's just not the case. And so there are a lot of bad polls and advocacy polls that are out there, and there's not much you can do about it. It's in the system.
Let's talk a little about, in the concluding of this interview, about the public mood, about America's role in the world and its relative decline. I get the sense in hearing things that you have said and written, that there is the people are ahead of the leaders on this, as they look to their children's future, as they look to China and so on. So they are, in a way, confronting it, this problem. They may even, well, they are worried about it. Whereas the leaders are in denial. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if the leaders are in denial, but let me look at it just slightly differently. And I think you've put your finger on it. And to start it off, we've been asking a question now, as other pollsters. Overall, do you think the country's headed in the right direction or seriously off on the wrong track? It has now been 12 years since a majority of Americans have said for a consistent period of time, not a short period, that we're headed in the right direction. And you have to understand, prior to that, we go through long periods where the American public would say things are headed in the right direction. We don't feel that. So the mood that you talk about, our sense of confidence in institutions, with the exception of the military, with the exception of EMS, firefighters, police, et cetera, every profession's standing with the American public is way, way down. And now when it comes to financial industry or the media, it's down at 9, 10, 12%, the same with the Congress. So all of those things set a mood. Then we ask a question for NBC Wall Street Journal, and that is, we asked this in 1995. Looking a generation ahead, who do you think will be the strongest economic power in the world? Among Americans, 54% said the United States. 3% said China. We asked the same question last year. 40% said the United States. 40% said China. And, you know, the sense that that cornucopia, that utopia that was always going to be, that's gone. That's missing. That's disappeared. So there's that uncertainty, which leads to the last uncertainty, which is for 13 generations, Americans have always handed the baton forward. For the first time, a majority of Americans think we're going to hand the baton backwards. And that's a tremendous sense of fear that the public has. So when you talk about the big problems, public wants something done about this so that there's a sense that we're getting back to level ground, that things are working, the sense that people's economic situation is standing still over a decade. That's disturbing, and it's a problem. And we're into much more a winners and losers society, and it's very, very hard for where we've been.
Now, our leaders in their public discourse, are they recognizing this problem set? I mean, they know it. They have the information. They can see the numbers as well as the general public. But they're not talking about it, or they seem to be denying it?
Well, I think more importantly, they're not legislating to ameliorate this. I mean, the things that they need to be able to do, you're going to do too late. And so instead of making the right decisions early enough to make a difference, we'll end up only at the last moment, at the last hour. And that seems to be how the Congress for now is operating. I honestly believe that if a forceful third movement got started, it could be very powerful here, because I think the public really has the sense that that somehow our voice is left out of the equation. Nobody wants the pain that you have to go through. But look at what California's done. They made the right decision with Prop 30 when they finally needed to do it. People will vote taxes if they know that it is going for their future and to build a society that they think is fair. What they don't like is the idea that I'm sustaining you for something that is unfair. Then they're against it. But the public is there. The politicians understand it. The problem is that the politicians are being governed, one, by money, and two, by the short-range need to be able to get through the next election. And I worry about the Tea Party guy on my right, or I worry about the ultra-liberal on my left.
So what will change this equation, do you think, as you get more and more dissatisfaction with the public, as reported in public opinion?
Well, my feeling is the public will change it.
Yeah.
And the public always changes things. And when you look, and we talked previously about same-sex marriage, public essentially in 8 years has changed more than any other period that I can think of for a social movement. I think in the area of immigration, the same kinds of things. So the public finally at some stage says enough, and the politicians finally get the message and we move on.
One final question. Looking to the future, how would you advise students to prepare for the future if, for example, they're interested in politics and public opinion?
Well, I think in terms of preparing for the future, I'd say get involved. I mean, the one thing people talk about students being less involved in the system, and it appalls me that they don't know as much. But I think they're very involved in public life. And when I say public life, they're involved in helping neighborhoods, being involved with underprivileged children, being involved in causes and communities. And so I think the whole area of social action has changed, improved. And in terms of getting involved, I think you can get involved at any level. I think the potentiality is the great thing about politics. It's meritocracy. If you're smart and you're good, and people don't care if you're 25 or 55. And so the openness of a system to be able to start at the bottom and be at the top very, very quickly. And the other thing is the sense that it's your future. That's what we're really talking about.
Well, Peter, on that positive note, I want to thank you very much for sharing these reflections on your life and your work.
My honor and my pleasure. Harry, thank you very, very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.